No other contemporary athlete has, as a tool of his trade, a device as fearsome and wondrous as today's racing car. Depending one upon the other, man and machine have forged records of every sort, won admiration the world over, grown steadily in sophistication and ability, all the while forcing each other to astounding achievements. During some years, one or the other seems to dominate. Fearless Freddy Lorenzen stockpiling super speedway victories in a memorable 1966 season. The thrilling perfection of Jim Hall's early Chaparral. Mario Andretti's effortless sweep of the 1966 USAC Championship. The Ford Mark II carrying America's challenge to Europe and burying Ferrari in a three-abreast triumph at Le Mans. But in 1967, the checkered flag symbolized triumph equally for car and driver. It was a year when both reached new stages of sophistication and refinement. It was a year when the thundering, dreadful machines and their brilliant drivers fused perfectly with each other, vaulting auto racing to splendid new heights of achievement.
Racing highlights of 1967, narrated by Chris Economaki, another Speed Sports special, brought to you by the Consumer Products Division of DuPont, makers of easy-to-use Lucite paint, the Work Skipper, DuPont hairbrush and comb sets, and Golden 7 oil treatment, the choice of champions.
Combination quickens America's pulse quite as much as the open-wheeled 1,350-pound, 170-miles-an-hour championship cars and the ice-nerved men who drive them. And while 1967 was a year of refinement for most types of racing, it was that and more for the United States Auto Club. The dirt tracks of old began to give way to road circuits. And with them came an influx of internationally rated sports car and Formula One drivers. Almost lost in the furor of change, A.J. Foyt and Mario Andretti battled to the wire in the most hotly contested championship in USAC's history. Perhaps the most memorable event occurred in Indianapolis, where Parnelli Jones and the revolutionary Turbin handed the race to Foyt when a $6 part broke three laps from the end. Parnelli, your career has seen you behind the wheel of almost every kind of racing car imaginable. What is your opinion of the Turbin as a racing car?
Well, I think it is really something that's going to come about in the future, whether we're ready to accept it or not. And more, it'll come first in commercial use, like trucks and boats and things of that sort. But the engine, pound for pound of metal, is just more practical than a piston displacement. And I think it has a great future of developing more horsepower and being more and more developed. So I think that we should not throw it out of competition.
And as the championship trail reached Langhorne after Indianapolis, it became evident that the Turbin car would not be a factor in the races on the one-mile track. The Turbin was designed for one track, Indianapolis. It would not appear again in 1967, but it blasted USAC into broiling controversy. By Langhorne, A.J. Foyt led the championship standings, his third victory in Indianapolis alone worth 1,000 points. Although defending champ Mario Andretti was not yet in the first 10, the season was young, and the fans could expect him to make a supreme effort for an unprecedented third straight USAC crown. Flag, Lloyd Ruby, in an untested Lotus, jumped into the lead. Al Unser, who took pre-race honors at Langhorne by establishing a world record for a one-mile track, shot past out of turn two and led for most of the 100 miles. Foyt wasn't competitive at Langhorne. Andretti, however, showed championship form, climbing from sixth to third, passing Roger McCluskey near the midway mark. The 100-miler was a surprisingly safe race. Only one yellow flag came out when Arnie Knepper and Johnny Rutherford collided. Six laps under caution for cleanup closed the field, and when yellow changed to green, leader Unser found himself in heavy traffic. Ruby, in car number 25, seeing Unser boxed in, found another groove, high on the turn and skirted wide, leaving Unser hopelessly behind. From that point on, there was no catching the burly Texan. Ruby raced to the checkered flag in record time, averaging better than 113 miles an hour. And so, another Langhorne 100 is history. Lloyd Ruby in car number 25, the winner. Al Unser, who set a new record in qualifying at number 5, was second. And national champion Mario Andretti, last year's winner of this race, was third. As the fans rush across the track to congratulate Victor Lloyd Ruby, that's the end of another hot day at Langhorne.
By September, the championship cars had tasted the dirt and asphalt of many ovals and road courses. The Hoosier 100 at the Indianapolis Fairgrounds was one of four remaining dirt track races on the USAC calendar. Three dirt races were won by Foyt, whose victories totaled four, including Indianapolis. Andretti had more wins, but still trailed the Texan in the standings. Mario led from lap 15, and the best Foyt could do was finish second, 11 seconds back. Andretti's victory in the upright Opie brought him within 60 points of Foyt. With five races remaining, the championship outcome was anyone's guess. A carnival atmosphere greeted USAC 2 weeks later in New Jersey for the Trenton 200. Andretti and Foyt shared the front row. The 400 points awaiting the winner dangled as a succulent prize. Andretti led from the start, shadowed closely by Foyt and Lloyd Ruby. On lap 5, Ruby made a play for the lead and tangled with Andretti, sidelining both cars. Foyt deliberately spun to avoid a collision, and he dropped to last place. AJ staged a brilliant comeback, avoiding four more accidents and surged into the lead with 30-odd laps to go when a failing Magneto finished the race for leader Al Unser. Average speed for the race was slow, as 50 miles were run under caution. Foyt's triumph gave him a substantial lead over Andretti, but they later exchanged victories at Sacramento and Phoenix, so the gap narrowed again. And the scene shifts to Riverside, California, for the last big race of the year. The Rex Mays 300 will decide the USAC national champion. A.J. Foyt, Mario Andretti, and Gordon Johncock in contention. Once the action started, all eyes were on leaders Dan Gurney and Grand Prix import Jimmy Clark. Riverside continued the road course challenge of left and right turns and brake-burning gear changes for the circle-oriented championship cars. Gurney led the initial stages till he locked brakes at turn 6 and skidded onto the dirt infield. Clark moved smoothly to the point with Dan in pursuit. Back in fourth, Andretti had to win the race with AJ finishing no higher than 6th if he was to take the championship. Clark led for just one lap before a blown engine sidelined the Wee Scott. Behind Gurney now, Bobby Unser, Roger McCluskey, Andretti, and Foyt. With less than half the race completed, Foyt collided with Al Miller's spinning racer. A DNF would cost AJ the USAC championship if Andretti finished no lower than 4th. That's just where Mario was running at the time. But Foyt had other plans. He abandoned his car and sprinted for the pits. Roger McCluskey had moved into second, and at turn 9, passed a faltering Dan Gurney to take the lead. To assure Foyt the championship, three backup drives were arranged in the event he encountered bad luck. McCluskey was one of those who volunteered to turn over his ride. Foyt's own backup car, driven by Jim Herdebees, was at the moment being garaged with an oil leak, so the decision was made to bring McCluskey in. Foyt would get only a percentage of the points awarded the McCluskey car, and the pitside mathematicians were busy figuring the finish position Foyt would need to give him the championship. If Andretti won, it wouldn't matter. But at the moment, Mario was in fourth. The driver change coincided with fuel stops. Andretti had an adjoining pit, and the drama of that moment made it seem eons longer than the 12 seconds it all took. Later, fate stepped in again. Leader Gurney needed a tire change. Foyt had dropped to 5th, repitting to tighten a fuel cap, so the lead went to Andretti, who had inherited second when Bobby Unser stopped for gas. Gurney was reshot in 26 seconds and went out in third, a half a lap back with a big minute and 5 seconds to make up. It seems unlikely he would catch Andretti and Unser. Foyt in fifth was experiencing trouble with the McCluskey Eagle, but had a lap on the sixth place car. Then it happened. Unbelievably, with 4 laps remaining, Andretti pitted for gas. The tired pace and the fuel demands of the engine had burned away Andretti's bid for the crown. In a spectacular drive, Gurney had whittled his deficit to 13 seconds. Andretti pulled out in third. Behind Gurney and the new leader was Unser. Mario was half a lap back and time was running out. One lap remained. Gurney went deep into turn nine, daringly inside of Unser, who, caught unaware, couldn't cut off Gurney's play for the lead. This move climaxed a brilliant display of driving by the native Californian, who overcame his usual bad luck syndrome. Andretti was too far back to improve his third place position, and that wouldn't be enough if Foyt could hold on to fifth. Gurney's Olsenite Eagle averaged better than 108 miles an hour, bringing him home 4 scant seconds ahead of Bobby Unser. It's been said that Riverside is Dan Gurney's track. No one could dispute that the initial Rex Mays 300 was also all his. Andretti finished 81 points short of the USAC championship, an unprecedented fifth for Foyt, although he needed help in the process.
McCluskey was drives for Lindsey Hoskins. For the race, told me in case I needed his car that I could use it, and at the time I got in, he was leading the race, so I owe all the championship to, actually, Roger McCluskey.
A great sporting gesture, don't you think?
Sure is. We've been friends for many years, and I'd done the same thing for him. I think that's the reason he did it for me.
Thus, USAC ended a year whose outcome more than fulfilled its promise.
Did you tell Roddy?
Coming up, more of the same from the sports car scene.
Chris Economaki here at the Daytona International Speedway. You know, automobiles and automobile racing have been my business for 30 years. And I want to tell you, if top performance is what you want from your car, what you want is DuPont Golden 7, the high-performance motor oil additive. Take the men who race cars for a living. They know what Golden 7 can do because they depend on getting top power and performance from their cars. You'll know it, too, when you add DuPont Golden 7 to your motor oil. Golden 7 does 7 things to give you top performance. It stops excess oil burning, boosts compression, boosts horsepower, quiets the engine, protects all working parts, cuts engine wear, cuts engine repairs. That's it. If you want top performance from your car, get DuPont Golden 7, the high-performance motor oil additive.
Perhaps the most perfect rapport between car and driver in 1967 was exhibited on the circuits across the United States and Canada where the big sports racers competed. These 1,300-pound speedsters, sporting better than 400 horsepower, were nearing the 200-mile-an-hour mark before season's end. And the men who drove them, first in the U.S. Road Racing Championship and then the Canadian-American Challenge Cup Series, also reached new summits of achievement. First, it was the slashing blue of Mark Donohue's Chevy-powered Lola, devastating the competition in the USRRC. Then the vibrant orange McLarens of Bruce McLaren and Denny Holm, making a shambles of the Can-Am Series. In each case, the championship was decided by a series of races. In each case, the driver-car combination was a perfect match.
We're going to run just as hard as we have to win. And if that means running flat out the whole race, our car can do it, and we're prepared to do it.
By the time the fifth U.S. Road Racing Championship event at Watkins Glen, New York, was flagged off, Donohue had proved his point by becoming a victory lane regular. In the previous 4 races, Mark had scored 3 firsts and 1 third over the likes of Lothar Motschenbacher, Sam Posey, Peter Revson, and Chuck Parsons. At the Glen, Donohue was again first on the grid, first away and first at the end. His victory was echoed twice more before season's end, giving Donahue six triumphs in the seven races he started in the 1967 U.S. Road Racing Championship. The Canadian-American Challenge Cup followed on the heels of the USRRC. Top racing stars the world over gathered at Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin, to initiate the $500,000 series. They were greeted with a surprise.
I think Bruce McLaren surprised us and just about everybody with his car. He, as they say, sort of caught us napping a little bit.
McLarens are turning some real fast times, and boy, it looks like there's really some competition here.
McLaren's flower power, a fuel-injected Chevy engine, and wide, wide tires were surrounded by a sanitary chassis and body representing months of effort and 2,000 miles of testing. Bruce planned to revenge last year's dismal showing. Most of the other cars were only modified versions of last year's models. Except for the Holman Moody Honker, Ford powered and Ford sponsored. Mario Andretti worked long and hard, but mechanical problems sidelined him before the race and for most of the series thereafter. At the outset, the amazing McLaren seemed the target.
All the locals have had to go a lot harder than what they ever thought they were going to go, and I think we stole the march on them. At least for this meeting, anyway. We don't know the results because the race hasn't been run, but in practice, it looks like we're the hot favorites.
When they rushed down Road America's long pit straight to start the 200-mile race, it was Holman McLaren up front. New Zealander Holm quickly established his preference for the lead spot, McLaren just behind in second. Paul Chaparral was woefully inadequate to the job, even with the new 427 engine. He ran fourth most of the race. McLaren retired relatively early with an oil problem. Gurney was to follow suit with a variety of difficulties. Surtees and Donahue had an interesting duel for second place, which finally became Donahue's. Holm took the checker with ease, a commanding lead over second place Donahue. The opener was all Team McLaren. Bridgehampton was another Team McLaren win. Bruce this time finished second. Holm has an easy time winning.
Was it a difficult race for you, Denny?
No. After the first 10 laps, it became reasonably easy. I was dawdling for a little while, then spun it. So I decided to go a bit quicker after that.
Round two to McLaren. But it wasn't so easy a week later at the Players 200 in Canada. Holm and McLaren qualified 1-2, but the field was waved off on the pace lap without McLaren. A fuel leak, discovered at the last minute, kept the team hopping. McLaren had to join at the rear of the pack, more than a minute down to the entire field. Holm quickly established himself in his customary position, and the likes of Gurney, Spence, Donahue, and Surtees were left to the now familiar game of chase the orange comet. McLaren, meantime, was doing some chasing of his own. In a dash-all style, long to be remembered, McLaren picked off the field with trap-shooter accuracy. Holm sat on the lead with effortless ease while his partner stormed up from the rear. Finally, as the laps began to run out on him, McLaren passed Gurney to take over second place behind Holm. But then Denny lost it at Moss Corner. The resultant flat, a severe handicap, but no time for a pit stop. Managed to hold things together long enough to take the flag. McLaren roared by just seconds behind after starting dead last. Holm won, but McLaren's drive was historic.
This is the kind of a drive you turned in today, was the kind of a drive that motor racing writers will be writing about for years to come. What motivated it?
Well, basically, just being so far behind. Yeah, it's a nice way to race that. I think every racing driver likes the opportunity now and then to be able to come right from the back of the field. It's a great way. You just forget about anything going wrong with the car and just stand on it.
The Can-Am contingent moved next to Laguna Seca on California's beautiful Monterey Peninsula. The competition was sharpening its fangs. Dan Gurney finally got his Lola Ford working and was the first man to break the McLaren Holm grip on the grid.
We've changed our suspension around quite a bit, and we've done some testing at Riverside in the past weeks. and we have improved our car quite a bit.
As we go on through the series, I think that the rest of the competitors are getting closer to us.
It was the first time in the series that the front row was not all orange. But despite some early promise, Jones, Hall, and Donahue were still not able to stem the McLaren onslaught. Home had to quit with a blown engine on the 80th lap, and Bruce had no trouble holding the lead and lapping the entire field to bring Team McLaren another victory. Nevertheless, at Riverside for the Times Grand Prix 2 weeks later, the opposition showed no signs of handing the series to McLaren's juggernaut.